Well, man, we have a great group together with us today. I know we have some visitors. We're glad you're here. And as Bill said, I will do, to all you beautiful mothers out there, happy Mother's Day. I hope you have a fantastic day, and I hope your children rise up and honor you in a blessed way today. But happy Mother's Day. Had she lived, today would be my grandmother's 103rd birthday that you hear me talk about so often. And I've been thinking about her all week in preparing this lesson. And I'm going to dedicate this lesson to her. And if I get a little sentimental this morning, you just please forgive that. I used to say, because her mother actually lived to be 103. I used to say, when we would talk about it, and she would say, you know, she was getting older and all of that kind of thing. I said, oh, you're going to live just be as old as your mother. Well, she didn't, of course. But I thought about it this week, and I thought, had she made it, and this were her last year, it still wouldn't have been enough. So she was barely 5 feet tall and didn't weigh, most times in her life, over 100 pounds. And when she told me to go out and cut a maple switch, she scared me to death. But she was a very strong woman. And I spent most of my childhood with her. And so I loved her. And when I think of godly parents, I think about my grandmother to a great degree. She wasn't perfect. And I'll preface the lesson by saying that. There were a lot of things, and she would be the first to tell you she wasn't perfect. But there were principles and lessons that she taught me that I think about, I guess, every day of my life. I think about things she said. I remember things she tried to teach me. I remember things she taught me that I forgot, badly forgot. And yet, when I got older and I became a Christian, a lot of times I reflected back on those principles. And they were some great lessons that she did teach me. Like I said, she wasn't perfect, but she was there, and she loved me. And I have told Montel, you know, she was the one constant, the one stable thing that I could always count on. And so when I lost her, I lost all of that. So I just want you to understand, I'm thinking about her as I preach this lesson. Talk about godly parents and fulfilling my purpose. When we make the choice to marry and when we have children, we become parents and we take a great responsibility. And if we treasure that, we will do our best and give our diligence to be everything we should be as a parent. And I'm going to use a phrase probably several times in the lesson, everything we owe as parents, because that's the way I truly look at it. What does it take to build and maintain a successful home and family? Now, you may notice this is very similar to the question I asked last week. What does it take to build and maintain a successful marriage? Building and maintaining a marriage and a home are what we do to fulfill our purpose if we have chosen, and most people do choose that route, to marry and to have a home, to have a family. And obviously when we're thinking about Mother's Day, we are certainly thinking about that idea. So what does it take to be successful in that? I think a lot of us would look around, maybe we would look within our own lives, look to our past and say that in this country, in our society, the home is really suffering. It is struggling. There are not a great amount of successful homes. There are a lot of homes, obviously. And there are many families, and that's defined all over the place in our time as people struggle again to define and redefine the family unit. But I think most people would be willing to admit that, if anything, the vast majority of home situations, family situations, are less than ideal. And for the most part, they're downright unsuccessful. So what does it take? I'm going to suggest that what it takes is something very simple, not easy to achieve, but something very simple. What it takes is godly parents. It takes two people making a commitment to God first and then to each other, and then to their children, to be godly parents in their home. I want to suggest to you what might seem to be some odd verses, and I will tell you up front that even though I believe very much in discipline, like my grandmother, I believe in that maple switch or the belt or whatever. But even though I believe very much in discipline, this isn't going to be a lesson about you need to discipline your children. I figure you know that. And, you know, it's not something that I, even though I will mention, it's not the bulk of the lesson, it's not the great part of the lesson. But I do want to mention some things that I, at least that I notice, that things that I'm afraid to a great degree we've lost. And I mean as a society we've lost. I hope that you have not lost this in your home. I trust you have not. But I just want to remind us of some things the Bible says. Let me begin with a passage that Greg read and emphasize verse 3 again. Children are a heritage from the Lord. You may have a translation that says they are inherited. They are an inheritance. Something like that. The fruit of the womb is a reward, the Bible says. We're blessed with that. But a heritage from the Lord. I want to come back to that a little bit later in the lesson. A second point I want to remind us is this, and it's a conversation that took place between Jacob and Joseph, and very similar to one earlier between Esau and Jacob. And Jacob asked the question of Joseph when he first sees Ephraim and Manasseh there in Genesis 48. He says, "Who are these?" And Joseph responds to his father by saying, "They are my sons, but notice, whom God has given me." It's very similar to what Jacob himself had said. And sometimes I wonder, did Jacob teach them, that is his own sons, Joseph, that story of meeting Esau after all those years, and Esau looking at his 13 children, you know, and saying, "Who are all these?" And Jacob responding, "These are the ones that God has given me." But to understand that they're a gift, that children are a gift from God, you would not have them if God had not given them to you. Now maybe we take that for granted. Maybe because babies are, you know, seem to be born, and so many babies seem to be born when people wish they weren't born, and there's so many jokes about how you were an accident and you weren't, you know, intended and all this kind of thing. Maybe we look at it like that. And maybe we've gotten to a point where we're kind of callous even about that, but understand that God is telling us, if you have children, they're heritage, that I've given them to you. Let me put up another passage here along this same line or this same sentiment. And that's from 2 Corinthians. And I'd like for you to turn there, or you can just simply read it as I have it above me. But it's the end of verse 14 and the beginning of verse 15. And it is Paul talking to the Corinthians whom he considers his children. And Paul says to them, and he's just really throwing out an axiom, something that ought to be known or understood. The children ought not to lay up for the parents, but the parents for the children. And it's the idea that if I'm going to have children, if I'm going to make a decision to have children, then I have a responsibility. I make a covenant with God that, if God, if you will give me a child, this is what I'll do. And it's the idea of laying up or treasuring or storing up. I was talking to a friend of mine in Montclair the other day. And he was talking about how his daughter is about to go to college this coming year. And he said he was talking to yet another friend. And the friend was saying, "Oh, you better get ready because, you know, you're not going to ever have a penny. That, you know, da-da-da is going to cost so much money." And he's like, "No, it's not. And the reason it's not is because I've been preparing for this for 18 years. And the friend said, "Well, how do you do that?" And he said, "Well, you remember when you wanted me to go to Hawaii and I didn't? The money went into the fund for the college. I've been preparing to help my child all these years." Now, I throw that out as an example because the idea in this verse, what Paul is saying is, when you take a responsibility and you have children, you owe. You owe your children. It's not the other way around. It's not children being looked upon by adults as the meal ticket. And notice how he goes on to say in verse 15, and I will very gladly spend and be spent for you. That's why parents do the things they do. That's why parents will do things for children they wouldn't do for anyone else. They will give themselves. They will give everything they have. They will give their last breath for their child. Because there's just a God-given affection and sense within them. I owe you. That's my responsibility. Paul said, I will very gladly spend and be spent for you. Let me go back to this passage that Greg was looking at in Psalm 127. You might want to turn over there with me. I would like for you to do that. And I don't often go back to the passage I have read and really look at it, but this morning I'm going to. I got to thinking about what passage I wanted to emphasize, because there are many, obviously, in the Bible we could talk about as if we're looking at parents and children and that whole relationship. And I started looking at this passage, and I thought about how years ago when I first started preaching that I heard this verse and I loved it, and someone was reading it and someone was applying it to the idea of building the church. And I've heard it oftentimes applied to that. And then I got to looking at it later as, you know, studying along the way through the years, and I realized that for one thing, it has an ancient title that may or may not have been there in the original, but it's very ancient nonetheless. And if you look at the top of it in Psalm 127, it says, a song of degrees, notice, for Solomon. Not by Solomon, for him. And then you realize that maybe, yes, it is indeed talking about building the temple, and yet Solomon, if he's building the temple at the time it's written or shortly before or whatever, as is generally supposed, then this would be whoever wrote it, the psalmist, whoever wrote it, it would be God's inspired advice for all those people giving all that time, money, and effort and so forth to building the temple. And they were building a lot of other things. If you read the context, we won't go back and do that. But they were very involved in building, okay? And so this would have been the advice for Solomon while the house of God is being built. And notice, it would be God's advice to him. So as Greg read it, and we look at it, let's look at verse 1 and think about it in that context. And I like to call this advice for the busy parent. We're busy in America. We're blessed. This is a land of opportunity. It still is, even though we have some economic problems. But it's a prosperous nation. You basically can decide at a very young age what you want to do, what you want to have, and if you work hard enough, you really can go out there and have it. It's not like that everywhere in the world, but it is here. And so people get very busy, and they get very involved, and they get very busy building their lives and their careers, and in many respects, building their house, if you will. And as they do that, God's advice would be this: except the Lord build the house, they labor, and the word really is for intense labor, working hard, they labor in vain that build. And when you think about that, I believe this is what the psalmist, I believe this is what God is saying to Solomon. I know you're going to get all caught up in building this grand house for me. And for yourself, and for all, you know, all of this building you're doing in Jerusalem. But don't forget, if you get too busy, and I get left out, it's vain. It's totally futile, it's totally worthless, and you will suffer because of it. So it's the advice for a busy parent. And I could go on and on with that, but I'm not going to. Let's go to verse 2. I believe in verse 2 when he is saying, it is vain for you. Notice how he repeats that. It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he gives his beloved sleep. Now I think about my grandmother, and I go back to that, and I think about the time, and the older I get, and I'm old now, okay? Certainly older than I was. In fact, what I am is about the age that she would have been. If you can think about what I'm saying here, I'm now about the age she would have been when I first started noticing all those kinds of things. In other words, I was a few years old when she was 56 years old. And so, and I looked at her then, the way a lot of children look at whoever is their parent, whoever is doing all those things they're doing, and she would be up before I was up, she would go to bed after I went to bed, and all those things that I just needed, she seemed to get done. And when I needed something else, I just ran to her, and I called her Nanny, and I ran to her, I said, Nanny, I need so-and-so. And she just seemed to be there with that. Now that I'm this age and I think back on that, I think of the effort that it takes to do all of that. Now I'll tell you something else. I was a strange little kid, I guess, but maybe not so much. Children are filled with questions. There's so much they don't understand. And there were so many times when I wanted to ask about things. And I would notice something. And to me, when I would take notice of something, it was the most important thing in the world. And it seemed to be that no matter what she was doing, if she was working and she sewed, she did a lot of sewing for people and so forth, sitting at a sewing machine and all of that. If she was doing all of that, and I went up to her and I said, Nanny, I want to ask you about something. I want to talk about something. She had time. And it just seemed to be that if I was crying or I was hurting or I was laughing or I needed time, she had it. And I think about that now, and I think, and what that meant was you had to go back to work. And that probably meant that you lost a little sleep that night. I didn't think about that then, but I do now. She took time. Time I needed. Time that was precious. Time that was fleeting. That once it was gone, you know, it was gone. When I got older, like all of you young people, when you're grown and you're almost grown and you're just grown, you're busy and you're running full speed, and we envy the energy you have, but you don't have time. And there aren't those hours and times anymore to crawl up in your mother's lap or whatever it might be and spend that precious time. My grandmother understood that. Thank God she understood that. And gave me that time. Because you see what he's saying in verse 2. Notice, this is an interesting verse. It's vain for you to rise up early and sit up late and regret. And I think that's what he's saying. All the time you've spent being so busy and you didn't have time for your child. Then you cry and you regret. And that time is lost. Because children, verse 3, are a heritage of the Lord. They're your priority. And in those years when you have them, those formative years, those precious few years between the time they're born and the time they leave the nest, that's all you have. That's all you have to give them those things. And then it's gone. Children are a heritage from the Lord. What he is saying here, and let's talk about that word. It's something inherited. It literally is a word that's used for an heirloom. We all understand, I'm sure, the idea of an heirloom. But this is from the Lord. This is something that's given, entrusted. You know, when you have an heirloom, you pass it down to the next generation. And you pass it there. An heirloom is something that it means so much to you. Maybe it was passed down to you. And it's way more than the intrinsic value of the item. There's a sentimental value. It means so much, and you are passing it down to someone because you trust that that person will take care of it and that they will honor it and remember that it meant so much to you. Well, this is God passing children to me. And this is God saying, I trust you will remember how much I care about that child. How precious that child is to me, and I trust you with that child. And the idea here is, remember your priorities. It's important. All those things you have to do are important. All those things that you are doing to make, quote unquote, a better home are important. But they are not more important than your child. And when the child said, you know, I'm reminded of Abraham Lincoln. I've told you this story several times, but it is one that impacted me so much. Abraham Lincoln, you know, the 1860s, the Civil War is raging and all of that, and he's sitting in, I guess, the Oval Office, but he was sitting somewhere in the White House, and there was a panel of people around him, and he's having discussions that will literally change the course of history. And in wanders Tad. And Tad is 4 years old. And Tad walks up to his daddy. And everybody is just flabbergasted that Lincoln hasn't jumped up and shoot him out or called somebody to get this kid out of here. Lincoln stops the conference, takes Tad up into his lap, and the world waits 5 minutes while Lincoln discusses the crisis with his boy. And that's exactly the way it should be. Exactly. Because nothing is more important than that child. That child had been given to Lincoln by God, entrusted with the caretaking of that child. Children are a heritage of the Lord. And you know, I believe verses 4 and 5, I'm doing a lot of studying about this past week, really focusing on verses 4 and 5. And the idea in the gate, notice that in verse 5. The phrase in the gate occurs a number of times in the Old Testament, and it's always the idea of where the business of the city transacts. You see it in the book of Job, you see it in the book of Ruth, you see it even in the book of Genesis, but the idea of transactions, the business, the government affairs in the gate or at the gate. Now notice this here in verses 4 and 5. It's the idea of your children and how your children become a witness or a testimony, even to your enemies, even to people who oppose you, the idea that they testify to you and your character. The greatest testimony a person has is their children. People are wont to say, you know, you can really tell what goes on in a home by the children. You can really tell what a person is, the character of a person, by their children. That doesn't mean that children don't grow up. Don't misunderstand. It doesn't mean they don't grow up and they don't have their own will. I mean, they have their own will and they exercise it early in life. But what it does mean is that you will be able to see the dedication, the work that's been put in by the parents by looking at the children or not. There is just something about those lessons, that time, etc., that is reflected by the children. And I believe that's what he's saying here in verses 4 and 5. The great testimony to the hard work that's done. Well, let me look at one more point and we'll be done this morning. Parents should provide for their children. We go back to 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Again, remember, children should not lay up for the parents, but the parents for the children. I will gladly spend and be spent for you. And we think about all the verses, all the passages in the Bible. Those I'm sure you know. But let's just remind ourselves of some of those things without turning and spending a great deal of time with them. But the idea, for example, of the needs of a child. A man that will not provide for the needs of his own is worse than an infidel, God said. You know that when you have a child, the child is going to have needs. And there's a certain amount of time they cannot provide for themselves. That's your job. You are to provide for the child. And while you may have needs, quote unquote, yourself, when your needs take precedence over the needs of your child, then God, this is the way God is estimating that. You're worse than an infidel, worse than an unbeliever. Because children have needs and that's your job. And beyond that, children need support. Now, this may be, if you're in Psalms, I'd like for you to turn back to 103, and I won't turn to many verses, but I do want to look at this one. This may seem to you to be an odd verse to look at when we're talking about being a godly parent, but it is the idea of God being a parent, and I figure He's perfect. So let's look at this. In Psalm 103, notice down in verses 13 and 14, and He's talking about the mercy of God. And He says, like as a father pities or has mercy on his children, so the Lord has mercy or pities them that fear Him. Now again, look at verse 14. For He knows our frame, our makeup. He remembers that we are dust. I think back to the patience that my grandmother had with me. And believe me, she had to have a lot. But I think back to the patience that she had. I think back to the fact that she somehow managed to always remember my frame. She remembered the things in life that I went through. When a lot of other people forgot, she didn't. She remembered what went into making me sometimes the emotional mess that I was. She remembered. And I could always count on her if I had one of my times, and I had them a lot. And I got angry, and I stomped off, and I did this, and I did that. I could always count on her to still love me. Other people might get tired of all of that, fed up with all of that, be done with me, but not my grandmother. Not till the day she died. And sometimes when she was a lot older and, you know, I'm now nearing 40 years old and she's nearing the end of her life, and we would laugh about some of that stuff. And she would say, "You remember when you got mad? I said, told you to do something and you didn't want to do it, and you got mad, you hauled off and you kicked the iron heater? Boy, do I remember that. Man, that hurt. Lost a toenail over that one." And we would laugh about things like that, but that was my grandmother, and my grandmother was always there with mercy. What I'm trying to say is this. Parents love their children, and they remember they're just kids. And sometimes there are horrible things in life that happen to kids, and it affects them. Somebody's got to love them through all of that. And you thank God for parents like your grandmother, who doubled as your mother and had the unenviable job of doing that, who was always there. They need that support. They need somebody to be there for them, always to be able to count on them. And they need training. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he'll not depart from it. We just talked about the prodigal son, and we looked at the father there. We looked at the prodigal son and how he didn't forget, and he'd had that training. Like Paul saying to Timothy, that from a little child you've known the Holy Scriptures that are able to make you wise unto salvation. How his grandmother, his mother, taught him from the time he was a baby, an infant. And children need encouragement. And this passage James taught us in Colossians chapter 3 and reminded us of a number of things. And I looked at that passage, James, and I looked at all those principles there in Colossians 3 in the first part of chapter 4. And I personally just tried to apply them to being a parent. And all of the things that are within that passage, the principles that go into being a godly parent, way beyond just working at a job and beating them when they need a beating. It's all of the things that you give to your children. It's the way you talk to them. The way you treat them. It's the way that you encourage them. And build them up. And children certainly do need discipline. They need training. They need to be taught things. And they need that teaching backed up by warning and punishment. And the Bible teaches the idea of the admonition or warning from the Lord. They need to understand. And that's why in the book of Proverbs, you have all these passages about, you know, spare the rod and spoil the child and all of that kind of thing. But it's teaching them. It's training them. It's teaching them what they need to know for life. And warning them that if you don't do certain things, you're going to suffer the consequences first in this life and then from God. And they need that. And they need understanding in all of that. Versus the domineering, overbearing, my way or the highway type person. The person that, this is the way I see it. This is the way I believe it. This is the way I want it done. Now, I'm one of those people. When I see something, I see it. When I believe it, I believe it. When I want it done, that's the way I want it done. But you know something? Everybody else doesn't see it that way. And if you don't have some understanding about that, and even with your own children, and especially as they get older, then all you're going to have is trouble. No, they need training, not breaking. When I tell you just a little aside here, I won't take long. But I love horses. And you know me, you know that. I'm not a big animal person, but horses are just different, okay? Okay? So I love them. And I had the privilege and the pleasure a couple of times in life of working with people. I really wasn't that great at it, but working with people who train horses. And I remember one of the common lessons from good trainers was always this. We want to train the horse, not break it. And you understand that when you've got a massive animal like a horse is, and you're training, you want to train the horse so that it responds to the teaching. But you want to do it in such a way that the horse maintains its spirit. Because a broken horse is worthless. About good for nothing but to hook up to a plow or a wagon, and that's about it. But a trained horse is really a magnificent thing. You want to train children, not break them. You want to be like the prodigal son's father. Patient, steadfast, and yet loving and forgiving. And I'll tell you, you don't want to be like Solomon. The book of Proverbs is a strange book to me because it's filled with fantastic advice of how to be a good father. And then you realize it's written by a man who was a lousy father. A man that governed his life by be wise, do what's right, do what I say, not as I do. And that just doesn't work, does it? When I think about Rehoboam, and you can go home and read 1 Kings chapter 12. Rehoboam is Solomon's son. Solomon was wise. The wisest man, perhaps, that ever lived. Rehoboam was not. If you're here this morning and you're not a child of God, if you believe in Jesus that He is the Son of God, and you're willing to confess that belief, and this morning you would repent, be willing to change your life, to live your life for the Lord, you can be baptized and all your sins will be washed away. You might not have been perfect in life. None of us are. But the Lord will forgive you. He wants to forgive you. He wants you to be one of His. Maybe you're here today and you've been baptized, but your life hasn't been what a Christian's life needs to be, and you know that. And you want to change that. You want to start over today. And maybe you ask yourself, can I really ask for forgiveness and start all over again? And the Bible shows us that God is the prodigal son's father. And He will run to meet us and welcome us with open arms. If you're here today and you need to come, please come while James leads us in the song.